delighted to have Paul Stoddard here. Paul was commissioned into the RAF in 1983 and served as an aerosystems engineer officer for 8 years, serving on the VC-10 and Hawk and the directing staff of initial officer training at Cranwell. Paul has also worked as a journalist and teacher before joining the MOD as an analyst, and he attended the Advanced Command and Staff course and gained an MA from King's College. And he's now an operational analyst with the RAF, as well as being heavily involved with the Royal Aeronautical Society and the Air Power Group. I'm delighted that Paul's going to talk to us today on the RAF and strategic air power.
All right, gentlemen and ladies, this is the first time I've ever spoken at a university, so I'm a little apprehensive about being faced with a whole group of historians. I don't know how many professional historians are actually sitting here, but if you see an error, please let me know, because I'm always willing to learn. The title says the RAF and strategic air power. I move outside the RAF, as I think the examples from other air forces are worth taking into account. The subtitle there, aspiration and achievement, is an indication of the difference that is sometimes achieved between, or is apparent between, what air forces claim they can actually carry out and attain, and what they actually result with. The two can be actually widely apart. So really, I'm trying to look at the issue of air power at the strategic level from about World War II through to the 90s or so. And particularly considering the lessons of history, you find a lot of people in the Air Force are quite resistant to history, if indeed they are actually aware of it having a particular role. And essentially, how Air Forces aspired to having that strategic role, and what they actually ended up achieving, is where I am trying to focus. Now, the term strategic is widely used and not always well defined, even by the people who use it most frequently. Some people seem to think of it simply as referring to a long-range capability, be it aircraft or missile or whatever. Others would simply say, it's where you attack a strategic target. But they don't realize, of course, this is just answering one question by posing another. What is a strategic target? And then there is the recurring air power habit that scale of effort sometimes seems to be equated with strategic levels of achievement, or certainly strategic levels of ambition. I'm sure you're familiar with the comment by the Italian air power theorist, Duhay, who, without any evidence whatever, made the extravagant claim that 2 days' intensive bombing of a city will cause a city's population to flee and presumably bring down the government and cause the nation that's actually applying the intensive bombing to achieve victory within that 48-hour period. Trenchard equally had this view that there would be this particular moral effect upon a population that came under air attack. It's claimed that he always used the word moral rather than psychological because he couldn't spell psychological. I don't know if that's true, but if anyone knows a reliable source for that, I'd be very glad to hear it. A book I recently read, Air Power, A Global History, by Jeremy Black, said, air superiority provides the opportunity for success, but certainly if misemployed, is no guarantee of success. And that is absolutely true, as I would hope to bring out with some of the examples I'll offer you this evening. The second point he makes is equally valid, I believe. And in terms of strategy, it is curious how, despite the fact that Duhay's extravagant claims were put to the test and very often failed, that they have remained extremely well supported by many people in air forces. One of them being Philip Meilinger, as he observed, although his predictions, Duhay's predictions regarding the fragility of a country's vital centres and the weakness of a population's resolve would have proved grossly in error during World War II, his basic premise has had an enduring appeal. You need a pick and shovel to actually get this belief in strategic air power out of the minds of some air power proponents. As Little Hart said, the only thing harder than getting a new idea into the military mind is getting the old idea out. That particular idea about the innate and unique capability of strategic air power is proving very, very difficult to shift. So we have aspiration and achievement. Alternatively, you could express that as rhetoric and reality, which I've taken from the book by Tammy Davis Biddle, looking at the British and American approach to strategic bombing. I would highly recommend the book, well worth reading. But there's a lot of rhetoric, but the reality does not always match it. sure you're familiar with the usual claimed attributes of air power, the speed of movement, the reach, its, the range at which it could actually achieve an effect. The fact it can be more or less ubiquitous, or at least can switch from one place to another relatively quickly, hence the flexibility element. All of these frequently trotted out by any air power doctrine guru, and yeah, they are true, but they are not the whole story. More importantly, though, there are certain requirements if you are to apply air power effectively. Awareness, first and foremost. You've got to be aware of the situation and also of the culture with which you are dealing. You've got to know your adversary. You've got to be able to develop knowledge, which is essentially putting information in its context. You need to develop the understanding of those circumstances, in other words, recognizing the significance of the knowledge, and from that arises insight on which you can actually base some effective decisions as opposed to just coming up with some idea you've thought of off the cuff. The Air Force is very prone just to doing things without actually stopping to think, is this the thing I need to do? And finally, empathy. Highly, highly important. You have to understand the values of the adversaries you are facing. The fact that something that they value may seem worthless to you is of no consequence. You have to see it from their point of view. So I'll try and give some examples where air power worked and where it failed and why this was. Why do some campaigns succeed? Are there common features? Is it just luck? A combination of circumstance, perhaps? Got to understand the adversary, as I've already said, and very, very important indeed, assess progress. Often, this is almost an afterthought if indeed it is dealt with at all in an air campaign. There is a great focus on activity and performance, but not actually on progress compared to the campaign objectives. You've got to be ready to adapt your approach if your progress is in the wrong direction or maybe slower than you hoped. And then there is the vital aspect of honesty in that assessment process. One of the cardinal principles of war, deception. And this was a sign I saw in an American air operations center put up by an American with a sense of irony. So that was a rare occurrence, so I made a note of it particularly. Deception is a cardinal principle of war, but remember, you are meant to deceive the enemy. Unfortunately, this does not always happen. People with a mind on their career will sometimes, of course, spin or inflate results as they pass them up the command chain in the hope of actually gaining the approval of their seniors. And this has definitely happened. A colleague of mine had direct experience of this during Operation Allied Force in 1999, where as the results of an air attack on a Serb position were passed up the chain, they were inflated at each stage. The air attack was actually on an artillery scrape, in other words, a little dugout that was ready to receive a mortar or a small artillery piece. But it was actually empty at the time it was attacked. By the time that attack report reached the general, it was claimed that an artillery piece had been destroyed. One had magically been put in place and then magically destroyed because somebody wanted to please his boss. Honesty is absolutely essential in this particular field of endeavor. I almost said game, but that sounds a little trivial. Strategic success. Some examples here, which I can touch on very rapidly as I go through. That is far from an exhaustive list, nor is it necessarily conclusive. You may well disagree. You may think I've left out some excellent examples, and perhaps I have, and maybe some of those that I have posed here are, in fact, erroneous. Maybe I'm way off the mark. It is very much open to debate. Thinking about the speed, one of the aspects of air power being popular with politicians is the notion that it's a quick fix. And sometimes you can actually get a very quick fix or strategic effect achieved relatively quickly. On the other hand, you can also get some very, very long drawn-out campaigns indeed. Examples here, we have Operation Herrick, not just the Air Force, but the British forces in Afghanistan, for about 12 years. Telic, this was 2003, and onwards for about 4 years. And then as you go through that list, the duration of those missions, some of them really don't count as campaigns, massively different, orders of magnitude different. And where I can finish off with El Dorado Canyon and 12 minutes in the raid on the Osirak nuclear reactor, 2 minutes, essentially that's just the time the aircraft were in the vulnerable zone. But it does indicate that you can have this one-off mission that may or may not be highly, highly effective. So you have that possibility of a quick fix, but it is certainly not guaranteed. Limitations. It's frequently said that one of the main limitations of air power compared to, say, boots on the ground is impermanence, that it is only there occasionally, it doesn't endure. Now, endurance of aircraft, particularly unmanned aircraft, is expanding, but it's still not the same as presence in terms of boots on the ground. And in the duration of the effect that you might achieve is also open to question and certainly to examination. It may be long-lasting or it may be very, very short-lived indeed. And it will depend entirely on the circumstances. Just because you've hit the target and you've downed the bridge or whatever, of course, there may be an immediate effect, but it won't necessarily be a long-term one. And there is also this bad habit of thinking, oh, we've downed the bridge, therefore the problem that we were actually seeking to fix by that action has been fixed forever. It may not be. Enemies adapt. They can be very, very flexible indeed, far more so than ourselves, and they generally are far more flexible out of sheer necessity. There is this recurring and reflexive focus on technology in the air domain. Airmen love technology. They love high technology, the so-called Gucci kit. And there is this focus on activity and effort. How much effort are we expending? How many sorties are we flying? How many bombs are we dropping? And in a lot of cases, people's thinking does not go much further than that, which is very unfortunate. On the other hand, I'm not underselling air power. It certainly has great utility, and it does remain our asymmetric edge in many cases, although that's arguably reducing, and particularly as we see maybe a return to state-on-state confrontation. And strategic effect can definitely be achieved, but it is often oversold, not least by DUE, and then, unfortunately, it is underdelivered, and so the credibility of the air domain is damaged as a result. Strategic scale of effort does not guarantee success. And you do have that potential of a quick fix. There was the comment by the American historian Elliot Cohen, who said air power to a politician remembers modern courtship. It offers gratification without commitment, unlike the boots on the ground, which is almost like a sort of long-term marriage, so to speak. You can only escape through death or divorce. And then that understanding point, which I repeat again, I don't apologize for repeating it because it is so important. Now, looking at the history of air power, there was that early claim to have that unique capability to not only achieve effects on the battlefield, but further afield indeed, and at a strategic scale. Results fell short. Technology solved some of the early problems, such as simply being able to find the target when it was dark and raining and so forth, as early navigation techniques were extremely crude. But that, again, is not enough. Although the technology has improved by leaps and bounds in the decades, well, 100 years or so, of serious air power effort, again, this is not the solution. It is not the sole solution. Strategic effect. Sometimes this can arise essentially from a tactical action, and I go back pre-World War II here. Charles Lindbergh flying the Spirit of St. Louis, it was the first case of a solo flight across the Atlantic. Not the first flight, but the first solo flight. Very much a tactical activity, a single sortie by one aircraft, a single mission. Yet, arguably, it had a strategic effect, very much in the long term, so far as the military is concerned, but in the short term, in the civil market. There was a tour by Lindbergh of the USA by air, and alongside the mail also being carried around the states by air to an increasing extent, there was this newfound confidence in air travel and this considerable increase in investment in aviation and a considerable increase in the number of passengers who were flying. It became essentially central to the American way of life, at least to the wealthy Americans at the time. But it also was the basis of industry. The aircraft industry in World War II, with its incredibly expansive and productive results, such that the DC-3 became the C-47, produced in the thousands for the Allies. The B-24 Liberator, that I think it was the most produced American combat aircraft in World War II. That may be the Willow Run plant, which at its height was pushing out one of those every hour, which is almost an inconceivable rate of production by today's standards. The Battle of Britain, strategic effect achieved there. Essentially, the RAF Fighter Command retained command of the air, and had it not done so, would Britain have come under such severe aerial bombardment, not so much the 2 days bombing causing the population to flee, but just an unendurable degree of suffering and death and destruction that Britain would have had to come to terms. Was this actually a strategic effect in what was the first pure air-to-air battle? I recommend the book. And then going back to the duration issue, possibly strategic effect has been achieved more frequently in very, very short campaigns or very focused missions. Maybe a single mission in some cases has been enough to bring about a major change. The Six-Day War, I'm jumping around in time here, but I think the point's still worth raising. 1967, the Israeli Air Force attacking in turn Egypt, Syria, and then Jordan. And the scale of the Egyptian air losses are very, very significant indeed in a very, very short space of time, quickly followed by equivalent levels of losses in Syria and Jordan, and the subsequent gains on land by the Israeli army. But the balance of power essentially was shifted in a day within that theatre of operations. And there would have been no equivalent means of achieving that shift in balance of power other than through the use of Air Force application. Going back in time a little, a near anniversary, 11th and 12th of November 1940, Operation Judgment, the Fleet Air Arm attack on Taranto. And not only was there the severe damage inflicted on the Italian Navy, but the ships that survived were taken to the north of the Adriatic and really did not play much of a role in the Mediterranean naval war thereafter. Again, a balance of power was achieved in the course of an hour or maybe 2 hours, at very, very low cost indeed. I think three of those Swordfish torpedo aircraft were lost, which in terms of an exchange ratio is amazingly good, with definite strategic effect achieved. Another near anniversary, 1944, but was it strategic effect? The sinking of Tirpitz, battleship Tirpitz in the Norwegian fjord, I forget which fjord it was, I'm sure somebody here would know. Well, when I say sunk, more or less, I think it just turned over and settled on the bottom. But at the time of the war, did it really matter? Max Hastings, in his book Bomber Command, described it as, at that stage of the conflict, as no more than a conjuring trick. It was done because it could be done. It was not really vital. People may disagree. The Tirpitz still maybe represents a threat to the Russian convoys, but probably not a great one. More a case of the Air Force having a target which they can attack, so they go ahead and attack it, as opposed to a target that really needs to be attacked, and there can be a difference between the two. Had they sunk it in 1943, it would have been much more significant. Excuse me. Recurring issues within the air power domain and its the application of air power in conflict itself. You often see examples of tactical excellence, the way in which air power can be applied, say, by the Royal Air Force or the United States Air Force, is of a very, very high standard at the tactical level. But there is that technology dependence, which I've referred to previously. And tactical excellence is great, but it is not enough on its own. And if we take the example of the raid on various German dams in May 1943, Operation Chastise, many people still regard that as having had a very, very significant strategic effect indeed. That is debatable. Surprisingly, for many people, if they were to turn to the official history, and probably few people have read that, certainly few people in the Air Force have read it, it was almost dismissive. The effects on the German war machine were not of fundamental importance nor even seriously damaging. You do not get that impression if you've seen the film. Has anyone here not seen the film? Okay. Where were the dams?
Mona.
Okay, the Mona. Where was that?
It's to the east of the Ruhr.
Yep.
And to basically block its water straight through the mouth.
And where was, and the other dam breached was the Ada. Yeah. Where's that?
It's in the same area, but I couldn't tell you.
It's not in the Ruhr Valley water system. It was unconnected and irrelevant, but it was breached. It was attacked and breached because it could be. The second dam that should have been breached, and it was attacked but not actually damaged particularly, was the Zorpa, for which no specific effort was made to develop an attack method or weapon to breach it. It was of a different structure. The Mona Dam was a masonry dam, known as the Gravity Dam. And the Zorba Dam was an earth embankment dam. You have a concrete core, sort of blade of concrete in the middle, and then two earth embankments either side, water side and air side. And the famous bouncing bomb had practically no effect on it. But the amazing thing was that although it was well known from 1937, 6 years prior to the actual operation, that the Zorba Dam was vital to the Ruhr industry, no attempt was made to devise an attack method. They just became focused on the gravity dam, the masonry dam, and the amazing bouncing bomb. They took their eye off the strategic ball and became focused at that tactical technology level. Am I going to get duffed over afterwards? Strategic aspiration, that remains the aspiration, but the focus is often down at the operational level in running an operation. Running an air operation is actually extremely difficult. You have the immense complexity of a big flying program, what is termed an air tasking order. They usually run on a 72-hour cycle, so you're flying one, preparing one, and planning one, and they are very complex indeed. And there is actually very little time and intellectual effort remaining to think about that strategic level. It becomes quite a managerial approach. And then, very often where the plan doesn't seem to be working, the response is to simply persist and to try harder, to fly more sorties, to drop more bombs, in the hope that somehow it will make that plan work. But if the plan is a bad plan, it's not going to help. It just is costing you more and more money to get nowhere, or at least only get somewhere very slowly. Understanding, I repeat again, you've got to understand not only the adversary, but also what effect you are having on the adversary. But there is, curiously enough, one case where sheer persistence and weight of effort achieved strategic success, and that is the Berlin airlift in that 1 year or so where the Soviets were blockading West Berlin and its civil population, at least in the western sector, of about 2 million people, with no means of supply via the usual surface routes. And a massive effort was made to supply West Berlin by air. And this is arguably the greatest example of strategic success being achieved purely by air power, and with the irony that it was that sheer persistence and weight of effort and organisational skill that was the key to the success. Unfortunately, that has not applied elsewhere. The book Air Power, A Global History claims that after the use of the atom bombs in 1945, the airlift was the most decisive use of air power in history and altered world affairs. Personally, I think it was even more decisive, but as ever, there is a degree of subjectivity in coming to a conclusion of that nature. Must have a strategic aim. And there was this very insightful comment made back in a symposium in 2014. Professor Luciano Bozzo, I think that's the correct explanation. In the absence of strategic guidance, the operational level will try to fill the void. That definitely happens. It frequently happens. The focus becomes organizing, repeating, and continuing that air tasking order, that 24-hour, 72-hour cycle of prepare to fly, fly, prepare again. And the strategic guidance, if it is lacking, the activity will just take over in a moment. And you can have these cases of what is no more than a strategy of activity. 1941, Fighter Command went on the offensive and expended a great deal of time, many sorties, put a lot of aircraft and a lot of pilots in particular at risk, with over 400 pilots lost. They claimed over 700 victories over the Luftwaffe in that period. The Luftwaffe only lost 114 fighters in northwestern Europe. So this was overclaiming at a rate of more than six times, which is high even by most Air Force standards, and a loss ratio in favour of the Luftwaffe of almost 4-1. This was just a strategy of activity. It was something they could do, so they did it, without actually stopping and thinking, what is this achieving? And really having a rigorous assessment of what they were achieving through the expenditure of all of that effort, all of those lives, all of those aircraft. The high claims were believed and accepted because it justified the very high losses. It became essentially self-perpetuating. We have to believe these overclaims because otherwise we will be seen to have lost. But they did lose. You need to do what is known as a centre of gravity analysis. Where is this? Where is the opponent's vital centre? What do they depend on? What are their critical vulnerabilities? And then go after them. Just because you have a hammer, don't go looking for a nail. You've got to find what the critical vulnerability is and find a way of attacking that. And if it doesn't need a hammer, you're going to have to find something else. Now, occasionally, a critical vulnerability is actually identified and then attacked very successfully. For example, the German oil industry, particularly the synthetic oil production, had very little access to natural sources, mainly from Romania. April 1944, the Luftwaffe consumption, 165,000 tons of aviation spirit. And with the US 8th Air Force daylight attacks, the reduction in output of aviation spirit for the Luftwaffe was rapid and dramatic. Essentially, the Luftwaffe was crippled. This was a fine example of identifying a critical vulnerability and then applying your resources effectively to it with very, very important and significant results. Go back to this tactical and technology dependence, looking now at the technology. The rate of change is amazing. When you think about the rate of change within, say, the maritime or the land sphere, you know, flintlock muskets were around for, 150 years, I think? Sailing ships with muzzle-loading smoothbore cannon, 200 years. 45 years between the first powered flight to breaking the sound barrier. That incredible speed, with all that it promised in terms of the use of air power in any particular area. But it did produce this almost reflexive focus or dependence on technology as being the solution to any problem that an Air Force ever faces. It is remarkable how deep-seated that view is. A problem arises, is there something we can buy that will fix this problem? Rather than stopping and thinking, is there something we already have that could fix this problem, but by using it in a different way? This is recognised by some very senior officers, such as Air Vice Marshal Paul Colley, about 10 years ago now, and he made this statement in a public conference, in a public domain with journalists present. I don't think it produced any earth-shattering change in attitudes generally, but air, as in the Air Force, has an unhealthy fascination with expensive technology. That is the first ever Swiss Army knife, 1891. It has a blade, a screwdriver, a can opener, and a sharp thing for, I'm not quite sure what that sharp thing does, but you needed the screwdriver to disassemble the standard Swiss Army rifle. But you show the average Air Force officer a Swiss Army catalogue, that's what he wants. Does he need it? No, he wants it, because it's bound to be useful. That has everything. Anything that happens, I can find a tool on it that will solve my problem. But can you use that? Can you carry it around? You'd need a truck to carry that around, or I'm just putting it in your pocket. And how much does it cost? And is it actually useful? I don't think so. Occasionally, though, technology is truly a game changer. And there is a term that I think is rather neat, where you do get these massive changes in the way that people do business, a radar moment. The development of radar and then the development of that chain home early warning system transformed the way Fighter Command was going to protect the UK. And it was a very, very advanced system, not only the technology, but the way it was applied in a very sensible and carefully thought through, well-organized fashion. The various sectors, the multiple lines of communication, the control rooms, the way in which the information actually had a time code on it. You probably seen the clocks on the sector control rooms with the different colours moving around the clock face. Each time a plot came in, it was given that, according to the time it came in, it was given a colour. So you knew how fresh it was. And after a few iterations, I think they were 10-minute intervals, if it hadn't been updated, it was removed because it was old data. So it was had this wonderful filter system, so you're only looking at current information. Very, very clever. And it worked first time out of the box. Amazing. Operational competence. Generally, yeah, air forces like the RAF and United States Air Force, they are operationally competent. They can set up a complex operation, an air campaign, and run it. And if you use technology sensibly, such as a radar system, which is backed up by a suitable communications system and a suitable control system, then technology can be very, very effective indeed. And indeed, you can still use such approaches to achieve strategic success. Not quite today, but in relatively recent times. Some of my younger colleagues don't remember this because they were born years and years later. They've not even heard of the Cold War. It makes me feel increasingly ancient. But Desert Storm. Air power shaped the battle space for what became a 100-hour land campaign in which the Iraqi army was routed. This has been described as the apotheosis of 20th century air power. On the other hand, it was pointed out that it happened in what was termed near perfect circumstances by the very distinguished air power historian Tony Mason. After all, if the Americans were going to design a war, they would choose a large Soviet-based army using Soviet-based kit and put them in a desert. And lo and behold, their Christmas came early. The air campaign of Operation Desert Storm was Operation Instant Thunder. Iraq at the time had the world's fourth largest army and the sixth largest air force, and it was battle-hardened after an eight-year fight against the Iranians in what used to be called the Gulf War, and then became the first Gulf War, and now seems to have been forgotten. That lasted, 7 years and 11 months. On the other hand, you had a 38-day air campaign and then a four-day land campaign. The application of air power utterly changed the balance of power. One element of this, not the only technology, but a good example, is the amazing improvement in precision, in accuracy that is achieved through the use of laser designation, laser-guided weapons, or more recently, precision-guided weapons using the global positioning system, essentially sat-nav bolted into a bomb. And go back to World War II with area bombing from medium altitude. The sheer weight of effort you had to apply just to hit one target was staggering. And there is no comparison. The technology there is undoubtedly very, very beneficial from an air power point of view. But again, I repeat, it does not guarantee you success just because you hit a target. So that technology trap, you do get that combination, that pair of beliefs. A technological solution to every problem. And even worse, history is not relevant because the technology has changed. And this is a very, very misleading and erroneous belief. You will find time and time again, if you speak to people who are serving Air Force officers and talk to them about history, they're not interested. They know nothing about it because they think it is no longer relevant. They forget that human nature does not change. The nature of war does not change. The character of war changes, but the nature of war does not. And we are essentially in conflict, in competition with another human. Doesn't matter what the technology is, you have got to change their mind. You have got to apply influence to them so they change their position. That is the only reason you generally go to war. Ideally, you don't. You try and influence them by other means first. But if you do have to go to war, you are trying to influence another human being. And you've got to bear that in mind. And history is definitely relevant because we have not changed that much. Indeed, we haven't in the 100 years, 200, 300 years, we have not changed at all. Early focus in the use of air power was solving many tactical and technical challenges. And so once you've actually solved those, you generally congratulated yourself and went back to the mess for tea and toast. There was, as I said, little time left to actually apply your mind to the higher elements. So you just had that theoretical approach by people like Douay, who made the extravagant claims on the basis of no evidence whatever, and indeed of no real analysis. It also gives the impression to some people that if you are competent, you will always be effective, that if you have high performance capability, that will inevitably equate to achieving success. It helps, but it is not enough. And there is also this focus on measuring effort and performance, in other words, how many sorties, how many bombs, and performance, am I hitting the targets I'm aiming at, rather than achievement. The focus must always be on achievement, but very often that is almost dismissed as being unimportant. We must be achieving something because we are putting so much effort into this campaign. We can't possibly be failing. Just look at all the sorties we have flown and all the bombs we have dropped. We must be achieving something. No, don't assume. Go and check. Air power strategic failure, Operation Rolling Thunder during the Vietnam War. Summed up by Philip Meilinger, not a strategic campaign, but an interdiction campaign and a half-hearted one at that. It had the appearance, apparently, of a strategic level aspiration, but in reality, there was nothing like that. It was meant to last some 8 weeks and coerce the North Vietnamese, ended up lasting 3.5 years, vast effort expended in terms of sorties flown and bombs dropped, going beyond the tonnage of the Korean War. Strategic persuasion was the aim, but in the end, all it really was massive tactical activity. Very well organized, doubtless, but so what? That is not enough. Assume that North Vietnam would not risk its economy to support the insurgency in the south. There were those four objectives. But essentially, an industrial way of warfare was applied to a nation that essentially had an agricultural economy. It was just not a match. We have a hammer. We will treat the problem like a nail. But it's not a nail. You need to have another approach. But they could not get past the fact that they had this big strategic air force, B-52s, fighter bombers up the yin-yang. This is what we have, therefore we will use it. Enormous effort, and indeed very, very high losses. Over 900 aircraft lost during Rolling Thunder. 0.3% loss rate. About 10 times, actually, the overall loss rate for the Americans in the Southeast Asia campaign as a whole, but quite low by World War II standards, but nevertheless a very significant number of aircraft. It also had operational pauses occasionally, which just meant that the North Vietnamese could recover, think about what had just happened to them, and work out a countermeasure. How long have I got, Harry? Oh, I'll have to speed up. They failed to empathise with the enemy. They did not understand what really mattered to the North Vietnamese. There was this notion about communism having this domino effect throughout Southeast Asia and the communists would take over the world. No, the North Vietnamese wanted to reunite a country that had been divided by colonialism. Always be suspicious of a straight line on a map. It's usually a sign that some Brit or French person has got out a ruler and a pen in a colony and said, well, we'll just divide it up this way. Never mind who lives there. Focus on activity, effort, not on effectiveness. And, yeah, it was a managerial approach, but it didn't work. And the irony, Robert McNamara, who was the Defence Secretary at the time, he came into the Pentagon saying, we've got to measure things, we've got to make sure we measure the right things. Make the important measurable, not the measurable important. And then promptly started applying importance to something that could be easily measured. In other words, the sorties and the bombs. You're probably familiar with what's been called the OODA loop, usually defined as observe, orient, decide, act. Alternatively, observe, overreact, deny, apologise. But you have this, decide, prepare, execute and assess. And there are two parts to that, the cognitive side and the practical. And they're not meant to be divided, they are meant to be in this smooth running process. Unfortunately, what often happens is you get that cognitive side getting divorced somewhat from the practical side. The thinking becomes disassociated from the doing, the activity. And rather than that dotted line through the middle, you get that hard red line cutting them off, and they start folding back on themselves. And the practical side tends to be fast. You can build and fly a day's worth of sorties, and then build and fly another day's. You can do that indefinitely, providing you have the money. thinking about it and achieving the results, sorry, assessing the results, that tends to be slow. And the two can become totally divorced. There is the phrase, get inside your opponent's OODA loop. So you're acting at such a rate they can't keep up. The irony is that we get inside our own OODA loop in this approach. We cannot keep up with what we're doing because we cannot assess what we're doing in time to decide if the plan is any good, and if it isn't any good, can we change it? And so the activity just carries on almost ad infinitum. Give you a scientific background or comment. Richard Feynman, he was one of the people who worked on the Challenger disaster investigation. Doesn't matter how beautiful your theory is, and for that you can use the word plan. Doesn't matter how smart you are, if it doesn't agree with the experiment, it's wrong. And if it doesn't work, if your plan doesn't work in practice, it's wrong. It might look beautiful on paper, and you might be very clever, and very often these people are very clever, but if it's not working in practice, it's not a good plan. And one of my favorite quotes that I'd always been told was by Charles Darwin, but apparently it's a misattribution, that, and he never said the survival of the fittest, but he said, is not the strongest of the species that survives, nor the most intelligent, it is the one most adaptable to change. And yet very often, the air domain does not adapt to change. It simply assumes a condition that applies or exists because it suits it to believe that. And it doesn't actually assess it or adapt to any change within that condition. You've got to assess your progress and you've got to change your plan as necessary. Another example, a bit short time actually, I might rattle through this one. Airpath strategic success. I think this was in 1981, the Israeli Air Force attack on the Iraqi reactor Osirak, kindly provided by the French. There were some components, I believe, of that particular nuclear complex that were on the docks in Marseille, and somehow the warehouse burned down. How that happened, I no idea, but presumably it was. But the reactor was going to come online, and so there was a potential change in the balance of power in the Middle East if Iraq were to develop the nuclear capability to have a bomb and the means to deliver it. And certainly the nuclear reactor was a fundamental element in the process of actually achieving that capability. The Israeli Air Force flew one mission and actually used dumb bombs from low level, unguided munitions. So at the time, they didn't quite trust laser guided bombs, so they kept it simple and it worked. The reactor was severely damaged before it actually went critical. I think before the fuel went in. And that prevented a major, major change in the balance of power. So arguably, that was a strategic success arising from a single mission. There was a later case, in this case, a Syrian facility, which was not actually admitted by the Israelis for a very, very long time after the attack in September 2007. And the International Atomic Energy Agency later confirmed that the site had been a nuclear facility. So again, the potential for change of balance of power, should Syria have achieved a nuclear capability, was, if this is correct, cut off. Again, perhaps a strategic success arising from a single mission. I think the jury is still out on that one. Operation Allied Force, 1999, with ethnic cleansing taking place within the Serbian province of Kosovo, NATO stepping in and trying to stop it through the use of air power. It was intended to essentially apply what might be called an air power lesson to the Serbs, to the Serbian leadership, based on the 1995 equivalent in Bosnia, Operation Deliberate Force. Operation Deliberate Force lasted 21 days. Some people had this notion that 3 days of attacking various Serbian targets would be enough to make the Serbs back down and cease the ethnic cleansing in Kosovo. It ended up as a 78-day long campaign. At the time, that was thought to be unbearably, unimaginably long-term. By today's standards, after Iraq and Afghanistan, it appears vanishingly quick. But amazingly, it was not until 4 weeks into the campaign that they finally developed the strategic level objectives. They just began bombing because they could and assumed it would work. It did not. They did not understand the Serbs. Lots of effort. Maybe the three-day approach was based on the fact that the target list could be serviced in 3 days. And so they just assumed, we've worked our way through this target list, therefore we must have succeeded, we must have won. No, you have not. There were other elements involved. Bill Clinton made the comment there'd be no land element to the NATO campaign, so promptly the Serbian army dispersed and hid very effectively. Milosevic, he wanted to stay in power, he was a Serbian president. And there was also that happy status for Serbia being the underdog under attack by the brutal powers in NATO. There was a limit to the amount of destruction that could be applied to Serbia, as that would be politically unacceptable and certainly unacceptable to major portions of the public in the West. And the fairly limited military losses that we could inflict on them, and they were pretty small, you know, a few tanks, a few armoured personnel carriers, they didn't really care about. They could put up with that almost indefinitely. Another book definitely worth reading, Robert Pape, Bombing to Win, focusing on coercion. Bad strategy thrives on ignorance. One property common to every campaign is that no one took the problem seriously enough to understand it. And that definitely applies in the case of Allied force in 1999. We did not bother to work out what the Serbs wanted and what they valued. There's Bosnia, the 1995 case of NATO action, Serbia. The capital, Belgrade, and then that province to the south of Serbia, which didn't actually have many ethnic Serbs living in it. Was it important? It can't be important. It's not a big deal for the Serbs. It is a big deal. It is central to their national identity. We didn't bother checking. They were going to hang on to Kosovo if they possibly could. But the NATO planners just made no attempt to find out why is Kosovo as a province important to Serbia. The information was readily available, but nobody took the trouble to check. So that lack of empathy. We did not understand what really mattered to the adversary. We just applied what has been termed the mirror image. We assumed they would be like us. They are all rational actors, but they have different rationales. We did not understand the importance of Kosovo. And you've got the usual suspects there protesting, but they always do. I think that was Birmingham, but might have been Wolverhampton. Yep. And it was really only when you found NATO being prepared to attack things like Milosevic's house that he started getting the message that, oh, maybe NATO's serious, that they're going to do more than just plink a few tanks. They may come after me. So he started getting his attention then. And there then became a policy of applying some coercive attacks on the centres of his power. For example, businesses that were owned by his cronies. So they were getting economic losses and putting political pressure on him. That should have been done from the start. And this is where air power does have its potential capability. This is the five-ring system as proposed by the American air power analyst and advocate, Colonel John Warden, that you have these concentric rings representing a society or a nation. The outside of the field of force is the army, really. You've got the population itself, critical infrastructure, system essentials essentially to their military capability. And then in the middle, the leadership. And to begin with, NATO was just having the field of forces. Why, when it could go all the way to the center immediately, was it chipping away at the outer ring? But it's when we started going for the critical infrastructure and the leadership that finally it started making a difference. But not until weeks and weeks have gone past with a lot of nugatory effort. And ultimately, arguably, it was the withdrawal of Russian political support that caused Milosevic to capitulate and Serbia to withdraw its forces from the province of Kosovo. Air power was important in this case, but it was not conclusive, despite the massive effort that was actually applied. John Warden, the deviser of that five-ring structure, he said, the essential components of strategy, you've got to define your strategic aims. This is at 2014 symposium, and develop a deep understanding of the adversary as a system and not as a target list. It is much more complicated than just a list of bridges, factories, TV studios. And yet, very often, we devise the plan before we actually have the strategy. And the chance of the two actually being coherent are pretty small. If it is, if they are coherent, it'll be by fluke. Oh, I'm sorry. if we're not making much progress, well, we just apply more effort rather than reevaluate the plan. And we keep focusing on measuring the activity and our performance rather than the achievement. We just assume tactical excellence will be enough. Go back to Pate. The ignorance, the failure to take a problem seriously enough. But in particular, the mechanisms by which the military effects are supposed to translate into political results are hardly ever studied. So anyone here looking for a thesis topic, good one there, ready and waiting. And he went on, and it was really quite a dispiriting read. I found innumerable studies of how to destroy a given target set, but no document to explain how destroying the target would lead to the desired political change. I can only conclude that they do not exist. It would appear that this is rarely, if ever, done, which is an amazing absence of forethought and indeed a dereliction of duty. Can we learn from history? Well, earlier I suggested that we could, but I also said that very often Air Force officers do not have a particular good grasp of history or a particular high regard for it. 2009, there was an air power course run at Royal Air Force Cranwell. A colleague of mine and I put together a lecture looking specifically at campaign assessment. How would you assess the progress in an air power campaign? We wanted to get away from the tactics, the technology, the operational organization, and just focus on campaign level, strategic level aims. How can that be assessed? And we chose Operation Allied Force, Serbia, Kosovo, as our example. It was one decade afterwards. Should be a good example, should be fresh in people's memories. All the students on the course, they were either squadron leaders or wing commanders, so majors or lieutenant colonels in the army equivalent ranks. We set up the lecture, well, not a lecture, a little seminar, really, to have a discussion about the operation itself. My colleague presented it, and it was a monologue. None of the students knew anything about Operation Allied Force, despite the fact it was an air campaign that had occurred during the time they were serving. They had all definitely been in the Air Force 10 years earlier. No one would have reached that rank so quickly. Well, barely. But there was no knowledge. And my colleague found he had to tell them what happened, where, why, when. And it was not quite a failure, but it was certainly far, far less productive than we had hoped. It sounds as though I'm slacking off the Air Force. It's great in many ways. I'm trying to think of one. But no knowledge of the campaign. And, of course, the irony of, you know, if you're going to forget the lessons of history, you've got to know them in the first place. And unfortunately, that's not always the case. Anyway, what conclusions can I draw? Air power can definitely achieve strategic effect. But, and there is a big but, effort does not equate to effectiveness. And persistence is not a substitute for perception. Definitely not. And this has been tested many times, and it's always failed. Learn from history. There are some very good lessons there, and they're free. Understanding is essential. You have got to understand your adversary. You've got to empathize with your adversary. You've got to work out and understand your strategic level aims. You've got to work from a strategy to task approach, not from the bottom up, as in, we have all these hammers, therefore let's go and look for some nails, but the problem is not a nail. We've got to work out a way of dealing with this problem that is not a nail. Assess what you achieve. Assess the results. Assess the changes that you bring about or are coming about in parallel with your own efforts. And be ready to change. Be ready to adapt. If your plan is not working, it's not a good plan. Change it. Don't be embarrassed. Because persistence and effort will not rescue a bad plan. Again, picking up on Robert McNamara. Very late in his life, he actually realized he made some big mistakes in Vietnam. There was a very, very interesting documentary, which I'd highly recommend, documentary film, called The Fog of War, Lessons from the Life of Robert McNamara. The main point he made, and he was specifically referring to America's failure in Vietnam, empathize with your enemy. Got to understand what they value. Better late than never. And finally, get the principles right. And that's it.